Several years ago, I went on a search for a certified birth certificate because all I could find in our house were copies, and I needed an original to get a passport. So I ordered one for $10 from the Indiana Vital Records office and waited and waited, and I was about 10 days from the deadline to get the passport in order to have time, you know, to get it in time for the trip. Starting to get a little nervous. So I ordered another one from a different website with about 5 days to go. It said it would be delivered in 3 to 4 days. I paid $25 for that quicker service and waited. And I was about 2 days out from the deadline and still had no certified birth certificate. So I went to a third website that guaranteed next day delivery, and it was about $50. So I ordered it. And at this point, you know, I've paid about $85 for a $10 birth certificate. And wouldn't you know, I received all three birth certificates the next day. So if I'll sell you one, if you like it. And you'd think with all this fuss over having to present a birth certificate to cross the border, there would be some important information contained therein. But all I got for $85 was where I was born, when I was born, and who my parents are. And I learned that 10,919 babies were born in Indiana that same year. Not a single word or even a hint about why I was born or why I'm here, but I can tell you I've spent a whole lot more time thinking about the why question in my life than I have on the when and where. That just hasn't meant much to me over the years. Why I was born and why I'm here and what I'm made for and who am I to become? Those are the questions that I threw out to you last Sunday. And we asked those questions in several ways as we experience different seasons of life. A 22-year-old and a 42-year-old and an 82-year-old, we're all dealing with the same question. What am I made for? But we approach the question from varying angles and emotions and experiences at different seasons of life. This morning, I want to take that question and kind of set it on the shelf where we can see that it's still there. I don't want you to forget about it, but today we're going to shift our focus a bit and put the spotlight on this question: why is God here? And we're going to start in Romans 11 and look at a few texts in there. But first, I'll give you the end of the story before we get started. So here's the thesis statement for this morning. God is painting on a canvas that's larger than the universe. And everything he does in every situation, in every circumstance, is done to demonstrate his glory. So let's read together the end of the paragraph that we're looking at this morning in Romans 11, verse 36. Next slide. Let's read this together. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. So right off the bat, my question is, what is the glory of God? You know, how would you describe or define what the glory of God is if you had to do that to the person sitting next to you? And I think the quick answer is, the bottom line answer is, the glory of God is God himself. One author puts it this way: the glory of God is the sum of his magnificent attributes and the eternal fame of his mysterious works. So the glory of God is not something short-term. This is something that's eternal. And the glory of God includes all he has ever done, all that he is, and everything he's yet to do. I think for most people we meet, God is in their equation. The universe is too vast, and creation is too intricate, and ecology is too precise. God is somewhere in our equation. We may not understand God, we may not worship God, but we know there is a huge and powerful variable in the equation which we may not know what to do with or how to think about. Mary and I were watching Planet Earth recently, and the commentator, who, by the way, sounds a whole lot like Winnie the Pooh, he was describing some phenomenon about something in the undersea world, and he said, after he showed us, you know, it was really beautiful thing that was going on, he said, this is both a mystery and a marvel. And I love it when smart people like Winnie the Pooh say things like that. You know, they're applauding God, but they either don't know it or won't acknowledge it. Instead of acknowledging God, we dismiss him or we ignore him completely. We challenge him and we rival him for who's going to sit on the throne. We love the driver's seat. We want to be in control. So we push God into the passenger seat or maybe even the back seat or sometimes even out the door. We would love for God to be our co-pilot, taking over when we get in trouble or when we don't know what to do or when we don't know where we are. It's like we acknowledge God and his might and his mind and his wisdom, but we feel like we need to be calling the shots for a while in our lives. And the funny thing is, all this stuff that we plan out still doesn't go the way we'd envisioned it, does it? We don't plan for the money to run out before the month does. And we don't plan for a little argument to turn into an epic conflict. And we don't plan for a good time to turn into addiction or an escape from stress to turn into an obsession. We don't have plans for the two-year-old to be the boss. I just witnessed this a few months ago. So Caitlin, who's the mother of the two-year-old, who's our grandson, she says to him in a very important message, "You are not the boss." And he proudly turns to her and thumps in his chest and he said, "I the boss." And so I ask him a few minutes later, "Well, then why is the boss the one sitting in timeout?" We get confused, don't we? We wonder how things could have gotten so out of hand. How could things get this crazy? And we may call on God to fix us or fix the situation because that's what God's supposed to do. And if he doesn't, we call him into question. And he better have a good answer. Because if he doesn't, we may write him off. And there are people walking around today dealing with circumstances beyond their control, which they don't like, circumstances which they certainly didn't plan for. And in fact, they've tried their very best to avoid these circumstances. So they're mad at God, and they say to God, "I'm finished with you because I can't make sense of all this." I talked with a guy who was working on a water leak we had in the basement a couple of months ago. And we spent about an hour together down in the mechanical room, and he asked me, he goes, "Are you a pastor?" And he says, "Can I talk to you?" And then he goes, simply, "It's been a tough season." And he went to describe to me that his sister died about 3 months ago, and his little 5-week-old niece died not long after that. And he said this exactly. He said, "This is just about more than I can handle." And so I listened to him, and he talked it out for a bit. And what I appreciated about this man is that these difficult and painful and unexplainable experiences that he's had recently, they haven't pushed him away from God. Instead, they're pulling him back to God. And he talked about needing to find better friends and needing to find a church family again. And he talked about wanting to talk more to God. And I'm guessing he's going to be all right, you know. Life will work itself out, but we may not figure it out, and we may not understand, because there's a God in the equation who's more expansive than we have ever dreamed of him being. And Paul's trying to, in Romans, he's giving us this new view, a view of this kind of reality regarding God, this expansive view of God in Romans 11, verses 33 through 36. The caption in most all of our Bibles preceding these four verses is just the word doxology. So Romans is about how great God's mercy is and how amazing his grace is. And he gets to the end, Paul is kind of describing all this, and he gets to the end and he's overwhelmed by the way a holy God can love such sinful people. So he writes a doxology. This is a glory statement. Doxa is the Greek word for glory. So he writes a glory statement about God. And I just want us to check out Paul's doxology this morning, his glory statement. Verse 33. We'll just look at these a few pieces at a time. First thing he says about God is, he says, oh, the depths and the riches and the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. I just wonder if there are any path tracers out here, you know? Anybody who just has to know where everything is going down to the details before you'll hop on board. So when it comes to vacation planning, you know, those path tracers, some of you are like this. You've made all your motel reservations ahead of time. You know the mileage between each stop that you're going to make, all the attractions that you're going to go to, the price of admission, how long you're going to stay there. You have a 3-ring color-coded binder for every certain day's travel, and you have a map. None of this GPS stuff. You've gone to MapQuest, and you printed a map, and it's in a binder on the front seat right beside you. Just a little, this is free, by the way, but if you happen to be in the middle of rural Alabama and you don't really know where you are, and you stop at a convenience store called Mapco, guess what they don't have? A map. I told them that. So that's not helpful. You need to change the name of your store. There are no maps here. You say no Mapco or something like that. But my guess if you're a path tracer, which is the way I'm kind of wired that way, if you think you'll figure out where God started the process and where he's going to end it and where he goes in between and what all will occur on the way, it's not going to happen. His ways are, we sang this just a minute ago, unfathomable. Man, that's a great word. We need to say that together. God's ways are what? Use that word in a sentence this week with somebody. That is a good word. You all know Mary and I have done quite a bit of premarital counseling with college students over the years. And we do our best to prepare whatever couple is sitting on the little red couch in our den for a lifetime of saying, I do. Because the truth is, they have no idea, nor do we have any idea what might happen. That young couple sitting there has zero expectation of any dramatic turmoil, any health crisis, any financial calamity. Those kind of experiences are unfathomable to them at this point in their journey. And those are small compared to what we don't know about God's wisdom and knowledge. Paul moves on to a few more questions that continue his glory statement, questions which aren't meant to be answered because answers don't exist. In verse 34, he says, who has known the mind of the Lord? And I hear in the back of my mind, anyone? Anyone? Charles Swindoll is one of my favorite preachers to listen to, and he says this about understanding God. He says it's like trying to unscrew the inscrutable. I really like that. Maybe an easier question is, who understands the minds of the people that you live with in your house? I mean, how many of you teenagers don't understand your parents? The older you get, the less they know. And it's unfathomable how dumb they can be sometimes. Try this on. I found this picture recently. What man can understand the mind of a woman? Us men, we're pretty simple. We're on or we're off, you know. There's one switch. Women, you got dials and rheostats and photo cells and sensors and who knows. We can't understand the mind of the person we're married to. And then Paul says, who can understand the mind of the Lord? God has a very high IQ. And nobody understands the mind of the Lord. Who has been his counselor? Paul asks. When God is having a problem and he goes and he lays on the couch, who's his therapist with the clipboard that's going to start billing him by the hour? Verse 35, who has ever given to God that God should repay him? Anyone? Well, you may say, I give to God. I tithe. I give my money to God. And I would say, no, we really don't give to God, do we? We may give back to God, which is the way we heard it worded this morning by Terry, and that's honest. And we may give back to God what's already His. You may give His money back to Him. It would be pretty cool to say, okay, God, remember when I gave you that $1,000? Now, you see, I need you to do this for me. But it doesn't work too well when you give back to God His own $1,000. It's like your neighbor returning your drill, and he says, here's your drill, now you owe me. It doesn't work that way. And remember, God owns how much? Let's say that together. God owns it all. He owns it all. We have come a long way in our culture, in our society. There's so many great inventions. The cell phone, you know, it's changed our lives. You know, I wonder, did somebody come up with that technology on their own? You know, it's made a lot of people tons of money and created no telling how many thousands of jobs. I'm amazed when I go to the Philippines, where the average annual income is like $600 a year. Everywhere you see people, you see them with a cell phone. I mean, how does that happen? I guarantee you, a brilliant research guy in the back room of the lab didn't say to God one day, God, I'm on the verge of something that's going to blow your mind. Absolutely blow you out of the heavens. People are going to be able to talk without any wires or cords. It's going to be amazing. I think it's really just the opposite. Here stands this fairly common engineer, and God says to him, you may want to sit down because I'm about to share an idea with you that will blow your mind. See, God is, he's never surprised by us. He's never surprised by what we think. He's never surprised by what we come up with, by what we build or design or create. So, you know, whose idea has generated all this money and business? It all comes from God. He gives us everything we have, all the money, all the stuff. He owns it all, and we give back to him what's already his. The question is not how much are we going to give to God. The question is, the better question is, how much of God's money are we going to choose to keep for ourselves? And here's the problem. If we're able to give to God, he might be indebted to us. So Paul asks, who has given to God that God should repay him? Who does God owe? You know, does God owe anybody in here? God doesn't owe anybody anything. He is totally debt-free. He's on the Dave Ramsey plan. Or rather, Dave Ramsey is on God's plan. You could say he has a lot of margin in his finances. There's no long-term debt. There's no short-term debt. There's no revolving credit. There are no equity loans. He's not refinancing because the rates are low. He doesn't owe anybody anything. And let's be honest about this. This may hurt a little bit. God doesn't owe you a nice life. He doesn't owe you a happy life. He doesn't owe you a good job, a hefty paycheck, a family. He doesn't owe you health. He doesn't owe you heaven. He doesn't owe you a single thing. Well, there is one thing. He does owe each of us judgment because that's the penalty for our sin. He owes us judgment and death. No one has ever given anything to God that God should repay him. So Paul comes to his conclusion in verse 36, for from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. You and I, we need a lens change. We need to start looking through the right end of the telescope. You could spend your entire life looking through the wrong end, and if you do that, things look really small. But you see, God is saying it works a lot better if you turn the telescope around and you get on your knees and you look up to see the glory of God. And when you look up, you'll see a couple of things. You'll see a God who knows who he is. Isaiah 42:8, this is what Jeff read a moment ago. I am the Lord, this is my name, and I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols. God is not having an identity crisis. God is altogether lovely, altogether worthy, altogether wonderful. He's got it all together, and that's why we worship him. He knows who he is. He knows where he came from. He knows where he's going. He knows what he's doing. We read that in John 13:3 last week. Jesus got up. He knew where he was come from. He knew where he had come from. He knew where he was going. So he took the towel from around his waist and he was able to wash the disciples' feet. See, part of the job description of being God is that you're all knowing. You have to know everything to be God. That's what we say about each other. Oh, he thinks he's God. Well, when we say that, it's like, oh, he thinks he knows everything, you know? And that's the one thing that God knows. He knows everything. And one of the things he knows is that he's God. He's absolutely sure of this, and he's absolutely sure that no one else is God. Isaiah 46, verse 9 and 10. I am God, and there is what? No other. I am God, and there is? I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I say my purpose will stand, and I will do that. I will do all that I please. It sounds to me like the Israelites were thinking there just might be some other gods, or they might be thinking they could be God. They could have been saying to God, I'd a boss. And God knows who he is, and he knows he's the only God, and he knows there is no other. So consider this. When you look up, you'll see that God is also stuck on himself. Now, you may not like the way I've worded that. It sounds kind of bad. It makes God sound arrogant or cocky or conceited. It makes him sound like he thinks he's all that. But I want you to think this through. If one of us is stuck on ourselves, words like arrogant or cocky or conceited would be true, but God isn't like us. God is God. He's not like any of us. It would not be good for me to be full of myself. But for God to be full of himself, that's a great thing. That means he's full of what? He's full of love and mercy and holiness and grace and wisdom and kindness and patience and that great word hesed that we looked at a little bit last year. He's full of hesed, giving people everything who have a right to deserve nothing. He gives them everything. Who else would you want God to be full of? You want him to be stuck on you? You want him to be stuck on me? He has no options. He has to put himself first because he's God, and he knows he's God, and there is no other. So when you look up, you'll see that God is also motivated. In every single thing he does, he is motivated by his glory. In everything he gets involved with, he's thinking about being on display, showing the sum of his magnificent attributes and declaring the eternal fame of his mysterious works. The first question God asks when he jumps into something is, how can this make my name great? He's committed fully to that agenda. Everything he does with his glory in mind. You remember last week when we asked the question about our purpose in life, why am I here? Maybe this concept points us in the right direction. Maybe we were born for God's glory. Maybe our purpose is to glorify God. Psalm 19 begins with this line, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. He made the universe with his glory in mind. So we can look up and realize that there's something much bigger than us out there. We realize there may be a God in the equation. And God was thinking about what would reflect himself when he made the universe. He put himself on display when he recreated all we see and all that's beyond our capabilities to see. God says, as far as you go, there is more of me to see. Psalm 8 says, what is man that you're mindful of him, the son of man, that you care for him? When God made you, he was thinking of his glory. You and I are made in the image of God. Something of God was pressed into the fabric of our DNA. And why would he do that? So you and I could be the very best reflector of his glory. When we say we're to glorify God, that's exactly what we're talking about. We are a reflection of the sum of his magnificent attributes, and we tell of the eternal fame of his mysterious works. Every breath, every step, every word of ours is a testimony to an awesome and amazing God. And you and I are in this world for one purpose. You talk about simplifying your life, here it is. You're on this planet for a single purpose. You're on this planet to glorify God, to reflect the wonder of who he is. Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and, what's the next word? It's for him. We're each unique. And all those little things about you that's unique, God is saying he wants to weave that into the fabric of his glory. Just think about this. There are 6 billion of us on this planet, and not one of us has the same sense of humor, the same thought process. Not one of us has the same emotional response or the same fingerprint or the path of life. None of us have had exactly the same circumstances in our world. And there's just one God who's never needed anything, who's never borrowed anything, who's never owed anything, who knows everything, who's created everything, who's loving and merciful and kind and patient and tough and powerful and all together. And it's the glory of that God that all of us, with our distinctions and our uniquenesses, rally around and live for. And God says, that's what I had in mind when I created you. You and I are on this planet to reflect God's glory. That's the sum of our life's work. We are his body of work. So I wonder, do you feel pretty small about now? And if you do, that might not be a bad way to feel, because the idea is to make God seem huge and awesome. And the truth is, you and I really are small and insignificant, except for the truth that God loves us. And as small and insignificant as you are, he's invited you to come close and to know him and to be known by him. And I just want you to think about that. That is an amazing reality, that God chose you to know him. God chose you to know him. He gives you the invitation of spending forever walking with the one who created all you'll ever know. He gives you an invitation of showing the world the magnificence of your creator. And he gives you the opportunity to live with a view of life that's larger than the heavens. We're going to sing a couple of songs. And as we sing those, I just want you to take a moment and compare God's invitation to whatever other invitations you've accepted which pretend to give your life purpose. And maybe it's time for you to make a shift in your view of life and begin living with God's purpose in mind. And we're here to talk about that, if that's what you'd like to this morning. Let's stand together and sing.